Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Having a public sex offender registry is a bad idea. It makes emotional sense, but it doesn't make practical sense. Enough is enough. Do we really think these people need to serve even more time?
What if we had a show about solutions?
You know, a repair manual for the real world.
Not the same old left versus right.
I am right, I'm right. And you are wrong.
Boring.
Yeah, something new.
Yeah, something new. How to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
How do we fix it?
How do we fix it?
So, Jim, today's show, I think, is a tough one. It's about sex offenders, which is a difficult subject. They're rightly reviled for the depravity of their crimes, but there's a real controversy brewing over how they're treated.
Yeah, specifically over the sex offender registry. You know, it's one of those things that it sounds like a good idea, and everybody thinks it's a good idea, but when you start looking into it, there's some real problems.
And it was in response to several pretty horrific crimes that got a great deal of media coverage.
Right. Now, our guest says that the treatment of sex offenders is really kind of out of whack.
And that the sex offenders registry is really counterproductive, not only not fair, but simply doesn't work.
Right. So our guest is Emily Horowitz. She's a sociology professor at St. Francis College in Brooklyn, a researcher and advocate in criminal justice, and an expert in wrongful conviction. Her recent book is called Protecting Our Kids, How Sex Offender Laws Are Failing.
So, Emily, how many people are there on the sex offenders registry in the United States right now?
Over 800,000, and it grows every year. And those are people who are publicly listed on the internet with all of their personal information, photographs, and these are all people who have served time and completed probation and parole.
So we're talking about something that lives on for people after they've been convicted, after they've paid their debt to society, but they are listed in these databases that are easy to access. And a lot of people would argue, yeah, they should be. That's a good thing.
It makes emotional sense, but it doesn't make practical sense for many reasons. First of all, there's no other crime where you're listed on a public registry. But the premise underlying sex offender registries is that people who commit sex crimes are different than all other criminals because they're predatory, they cannot be stopped, they're uncontrollable, so they need to be listed for life. But that's not true.
Well, let's break down these numbers. 800,000, you say. Now, there are 800,000 very different cases. So who are these 800,000?
Well, a quarter of them are people who've committed crimes as juveniles. It can include fondling, touching, can include rape, sexual assault. It can include violent sex crimes. But the thing you have to remember is that in the United States, we have a pretty draconian response to crime. So people serve really long sentences. And do we really think these people need to serve even more time? They're given strict sentences. The recidivism rate, that's the key issue. The recidivism rate for sex offenders is not higher than other crimes. It's much lower, in fact. Particularly for juvenile offenders, particularly for offenders who are publicly shamed and serve time.
But I wanted to go back to this question of the 800,000, because it strikes me that they're often treated, at least in the public, in the same way. And some of them really are criminals, very serious criminals, who should be locked up for a very long time and watched for the rest of their lives. But there are many other people who, for instance, they may be 18 and they had sex with a 16-year-old. That's a very different kind of person and a different type of offense.
That's right. So statutory offenses, consensual sex between people who are above the age of consent and people who are below the age of consent are on the registry often for life. And as I said, one quarter of the people are children themselves who've committed crimes as juveniles, and they're particularly responsive to treatment. There's very few that are violent pedophiles, which is what the registry...
And yet that's our image.
That's our image.
You know, you watch Law & Order, Special Victims Unit, or something like that. I mean, that's the creepy older guy, you know, stealing kids from the playground is kind of our image of who's on the registry.
Right. The three federal acts that created the registry and have created these draconian responses to sex offenses were named after children. Jacob Wetterling, who was abducted and killed, but it's never been determined if it was by a sex offender or not. And in fact, his mother now recognizes the registry as a mistake and has become an advocate to reform the sex offender registry because she sees how it's gotten out of control. The Adam Walsh Act. Adam Walsh was a little boy who was abducted, and Megan's Law. Megan Kanka was abducted by a sex offender who was released into her community, and people weren't notified. So intuitively say, oh my gosh, they should have told all her neighbors that this guy who had a history of harming children moved to the neighborhood. It seems like a really good idea. And it is a good idea in theory, but that case is so anomalous and so rare to develop policy based on it. Doesn't make sense.
You know, Glenn Reynolds, a law professor at University of Tennessee, who's been on our show, he likes to say that any law that's named after a person is probably a bad law, you know, because it shows that there's that strong emotional component and we might be taking a genuine problem, but then creating a solution that's too broad and too indiscriminate. So I'm interested, like, how did you get started? Was there a particular case or experience that really got you focused on this particular part of criminal justice reform?
Yes, I came to it through my friend Debbie Nathan, who's a great journalist. And one of the cases she told me about was a guy named Bernard Barron. He worked in a daycare and he was gay. He was an openly gay man, and this was in the 80s. And it was a daycare center in a working-class town, and some of the parents found out he was gay, and they went to the head of the daycare, and they said, you need to fire him. We don't want a gay man working in our daycare center. The daycare center refused to fire him, and then a few days later, they said he was sexually abusing their son, and the daycare center then did all these terrible things that you're not supposed to do, like sending letters to parents if your child has been complaining of being touched, come see us, and, you know, all these terrible things. But the homophobia and hysteria in that case really struck me as a grave injustice. And he served over 2 decades before he was exonerated, and then he died a few years ago. But his case was...
Yeah, heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking that he went to prison at 17 or 18 for 2 decades. And he was completely innocent.
You're a mother of 4 children, right? Do you ever worry about them and whether anything that you're doing makes the world less safe for them?
I never worry about that because I do feel like, partly because of my work, I think my kids feel comfortable talking to me and they're aware that it's not acceptable. And I hope they would tell me if anything happened. I mean, I think there's very, very few people who are truly dangerous after they serve their time and receive treatment. And those are the people you want to monitor. But when you say everybody who commits any sex offense should be on this registry, you get into a lot of trouble.
Now, one of the dimensions of this that's been gotten some attention lately is the what's called civil commitment after people have served their sentence. How does that work exactly?
So after people serve their sentences, in some states, they can say this person should not be even released to the public, even on the registry and even subject to all these restrictions. They have to be detained indefinitely.
So this is someone who's sentenced in our system to say 10 years in prison, comes out, served his time, and then is told, no, sorry, we have to detain you for an indefinite period of time.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier.
Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
That's right.
Now, I can imagine that some people listening to this are screaming right now, going, wait a minute, we've spent, like, I don't know, nearly 10 minutes talking about the offenders, and perhaps they are mistreated, dealt with unfairly. What about the victims? Are victims typically attacked by strangers?
No, almost never. Over 90% of children who are victimized are harmed by people they know, people within their family, within their community, people known to the family. It's very rare that strangers sexually abuse children in a park, in a mall, and abduct them and harm them. This almost never happens.
We did a show recently with Lenore Scanese, who's the Free Range Kids movement. She talks about this all the time, that the way that we've gotten this idea that there's these, you know, bad guys lurking around every playground, their image of this is shaped by the media. How does that affect it?
The media loves to promote fear and moral panic. And I mean, we're in the midst of a sex panic that has been going on for decades now. It started with the daycare center cases where people believe that...
For younger listeners, not everybody remembers those cases and how extreme it was. Talk a little bit about the McMartin case and some of the others.
That was in California, right?
That's right. It was the longest trial in California history. Nobody was ever convicted. And there was a number of these cases where there was believed to be multiple victims and multiple offenders doing group satanic ritual abuse to children.
Weird ritual satanic stuff. I mean, these elaborate, crazy stories. And yet, there was very little skepticism at first about, you know, three-year-old said that they flew in through the window and then did X and Y, and nobody questioned. In fact, it was like very incorrect.
Right. You have to believe the children, right? Mm-hmm. Don't question the victim, even if a three-year-old changes their story nine times and they were questioned improperly. There was a lot of suggestions.
There were a lot of leading questions, and the children were led to say certain things that weren't true.
Right. Well, there was no awareness of how to question children about child sexual abuse. And so people started believing that daycare workers wanted to be daycare workers so they could molest children, which is absurd.
And there was this view in the McMartin case that these daycare workers were almost part of a cult.
Right. Yeah. Satanic ritual abuse, right? Mm-hmm. That babies were murdered, that there was underground tunnels. And a few really brave people like Debbie Nathan started questioning this, but she was attacked horribly for questioning whether these kids were actually being abused.
So that moral panic of that era has kind of evolved now into other sorts of moral panic around sexual issues and sexual assault.
That's right. And there's lasting impact. Like, men don't work in daycare anymore. Men don't work in the lower grades, in kindergarten, in first grade. There's all kinds of policies now, like no-touch daycare policies, which are really bad for kids to view all men.
No-touch daycare?
Yeah. There's these policies where you can't, like, hug the kids or put them on your lap. And, you know,
and when a child is crying, that would be just a normal human response.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Would be to hug that child.
That's right. And so it's terrible that we view all adults as potential predators and all children as
potential. That can lead to real emotional detachment. I mean, because that's also a problem with young children.
Kids are scared and parents are scared and it's a very bad situation.
Now, our show is about solutions. And Emily, you've come in with some very concrete, very specific solutions to the problem. And let's talk about that a little bit. Assuming people agree that there's an issue here, and maybe not everybody does, but what are your solutions to this?
I think that having a public sex offender registry is a bad idea. Sex offenders have very, very low recidivism rates for many reasons. Treatment works. The shame of being arrested works. You age out of crime. There's many, many reasons. And they destroy families. And we don't have them for any other crime.
You mentioned shaming. Right. On sex offender registries. Isn't that a major argument in favor of them, shaming?
The public shaming?
Yes, shaming.
I think public shaming is a terrible thing.
But
I think
public shaming lead to fewer crimes?
I think being arrested for a sex offense is a form of public shaming. I think that serving time in prison for a sex offense is a form of public shaming. And being on probation or parole as a sex offender is a form of public shaming. So whenever you're caught, public shaming occurs.
So your first solution is basically we should just get rid of or profoundly modify the sex offenders registry.
That's right. And so in California, what they did is they had to get rid of this because they recognized it was a public safety threat to have tons of homeless sex offenders. And it also was bad for society to have so much more homelessness as a result of a law that wasn't decreasing crime or protecting children in any way. The thing is, we know child sexual abuse is very complicated, and it happens most often within the family and within among people known to the children. So these laws are totally ineffective. Most sex offenders, it's their first offense. So you also, the sex offender registry doesn't monitor people who are not already convicted.
So let's get to the second solution that you have on your list of four, and that is to divert resources away from sex offender registries because they are expensive.
Right, and monitoring, yeah. Right.
And use that money instead for what?
Mental health and social services, education. I mean, the best way to prevent child sexual abuse is to educate and give kids ways to report it that are helpful. And one other thing is that in many cases, because sex offenders are known to the children and known to the family, because the response is so extraordinary and so draconian, it actually prevents people from reporting it. And there's these mandatory reporting laws. If you abuse a child and you're troubled by it, you can't tell your therapist because you'll be reported. If a child is abused, they're aware that this person will be publicly shamed, flogged, and, you know, punished for life. The case of Josh Duggar, the Duggar family has a reality show. That case really compelled me. He had touched four or five of his sisters inappropriately. And this is very common.
When he was a child.
When he was a child himself. He was a teenager and they were younger. And I interviewed a number of people who had inappropriately touched siblings or step-siblings. It's common. It's uncomfortable to talk about.
Lena Dunham wrote about it in her book.
That's right. But the parents kind of dealt with it within their family. They didn't go to the police. And they lost their show on TLC and they were publicly humiliated, you know. And I think that what compelled me about the story is that they didn't really have much choice, because I interviewed a number of kids whose parents had gone to the police or gone to therapists, and their kids had been taken away from them. Josh Gravins, who I interview in my book, is a very outspoken person about his experience. He inappropriately touched his sister when he was 13, and he was put in juvenile prison for 3 years. And he's in his 30s, and he's still on the public registry.
So those cases, I guess, speak to the third solution on your list, which is educating the public about the real causes of sexual abuse, and also talking about just how incredibly complicated this field is.
So in cases of like these sibling cases, I mean, think if you're the parent, you love both the siblings, you want to protect the sibling who's the victim, and you want to punish the sibling who perpetrated the crime, but at the same time, you don't want your family totally destroyed. You don't want the child who did that to be punished forever. And so Josh Gravins has become this outspoken advocate because he's still on the registry and he's still dealing with the effects. Most people who are rearrested on the registry is for violating the terms of the registry, not another sex offense. So he moved recently and didn't update his address during the right time period, and now he's facing jail again. And he's never reoffended.
Right. I mean, what other crime that somebody would commit when they're 13 carries that kind of lifelong consequence? And isn't this partly related to this idea that was promoted by some psychologists that this is, you know, it's almost like being a serial killer or something. This is some deep-seated compulsion that's going to be lifelong, and these people are always going to be a threat.
That's right. That's right. And actually, there was an article just published a few days ago about how in many court decisions, they use bad data and junk science by saying sex offenders have frighteningly high rates of reoffense. This isn't true. There's no research or data that shows that.
When you say very low, what do you mean?
It ranges from some as low as 3%, some up to 10 or 15%, and it differs by type of offense and age of offender, but it's very, very low compared to every other crime.
Now, we've been talking about the importance of educating the public and educating children and helping families. What about sex offenders themselves? There's a program called Circles of Support and Accountability. Are there things that can be done apart from just locking sex offenders up or throwing them onto a sex offenders registry that will help them not just in terms of support, but just help them with understanding what they've
done.
That's
right. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that sex offender treatment is effective. It's not just the public shaming of going to prison and everything else, but treatment works, being aware that you're harming children works. Sex offender treatment is effective, according to many studies. So there's lots of things you can do to decrease recidivism even lower. But I think for all crimes, the best way to decrease recidivism and prevent crimes is to help people who've served their time rebuild their lives, because you're much less likely to reoffend if you have a stable job, if you have a stable home. If you're dealing with public shaming every single day, it's really hard.
So the registry makes everything else about this problem worse rather than better.
Far worse, far worse.
So educating the public about child sexual abuse, really important subject. What are the causes of child sexual abuse?
I think what's more important than trying to figure out the causes is to educate people and make it clear it's not acceptable that it happens. I think one of the things that related to the decline in sexual abuse that happened in the early 90s was that in the 70s and 80s, it became publicized. People were open about it. People used to not talk about it. It was hidden. It was a shameful thing. It was not recognized. If children did report it, they'd say, don't report it. Like, you're going to ruin the family. Don't talk about it. So talking about it and making it public and shedding light on it and making it clear it's not acceptable, that children should say no and that adults should not do this, that's one of the key ways to prevent it.
So the one-size-fits-all approach clearly doesn't work. I think we've established that. Emily Horowitz, sociology professor, thanks very much. So, Jim, this is a very tangled, complicated topic, but as so often happens with the way these things are debated, I'm concerned about both sides of the argument talking past each other. The victims, their lives have been ruined in many cases by sex offenders. And I feel that needs to be a very important focus of any debate. If the sex offender registry leads to more safety, then maybe it's not such a bad thing. If, on the other hand, it leads to these offenders being so isolated from society that they become even worse as people, then it is counterproductive.
Right. And one thing that, you know, she points out in her work is that there isn't that much evidence that these registries really do prevent future crimes. And now, it's probably a hard thing to measure precisely. And I can certainly understand parents and others who just want that added knowledge. They just want to know, and they feel they have a right to know. Those are strong arguments. But I think that where I'm most persuaded is the huge number of people who are on these registries who are not the clear-cut predator type.
Right.
They've done something wrong. I mean, I think she's honest that these are real crimes, and people need to go to jail for these things, you know, and they should. But are we actually succeeding in protecting future victims with this whole elaborate registry thing? I'm pretty convinced it's not doing much to help those victims.
Right. As long as we're talking in our conversation about victims, I'm comfortable with that. And I agree with you. The one-size-fits-all nature of the sex offenders registry, 800,000 people, some, many, who committed fairly minor crimes when they were children, being thrown onto this and lumped together with serial rapists, there's a real problem there.
Yeah, and I think in our popular culture, there's this strong desire to promote this idea of this kind of super predator. And there's been research saying that, you know, campus rape cases are these serial rapists. And then it turns out that research really was not germane to that question at all. There's an image in a lot of popular culture from, you know, Law and Order and other shows that there's these people lurking around that are going to commit these crimes again and again. In the cases where that's true, we have to, you know, do everything we can to isolate those people. But that's probably not as much the norm as we all tend to believe.
And there is this, as you mentioned to me, gleeful public shaming of people who are critical of the way society is treating sex offenders.
I mean, any legislator who's willing to even look at reforming these has got a lot of guts.
We want to leave our listeners with a sense of fixes, of solutions. So let's walk through them, Jim. Emily says, get rid of the sex offenders registry.
Right. I mean, her argument is that it's expensive. It gives a false sense of security. And it prevents people from reentering society and in ways that maybe make the problem worse rather than better.
I certainly agree that it needs to be cut back. I'm not sure I agree that getting rid of it completely is a good idea.
Now, her second suggestion is to divert resources away from the registry and, you know, monitoring the sex offenders and into mental health and other services that can help reintegrate people into society. And what was interesting to me, and I think a positive thing, is how successful some of this intervention is and how low the rate of recidivism is with this population.
Yeah, and just the vast cost of that sexual offenders registry, using some of that money in this way, I think is a constructive idea.
Right. And then her third idea, which is pretty basic, just to educate the public. And she thinks that a lot of the decline in sex offenses has related to just growing awareness. You know, there's been a cultural shift, and I think a really healthy one, just in my lifetime on how people view these issues. And I think
and that they can talk about these things.
Right, and we've got to continue that.
Yeah, I agree. Four, reforming the criminal justice response to sex offenders, getting rid of the one-size-fits-all approach. I agree with her. I also think that civil commitment, this idea that once you've served, say, 10 years in prison for a sexual offense, all of a sudden somebody comes to you and goes, no, sorry, that's not enough. You need to spend another indefinite amount of time behind bars or in a confined facility. That's wrong. I mean,
at great expense and with no clear kind of legal rules around how long you're going to stay in or what you need to do to get out. So we are starting to see a little bit of a wave of reform. And a really important case, the Jessica's Law in California, wasn't repealed, but it was rolled back. And specifically, they were taking offenders, maybe someone whose victim was an adult, and they were saying, oh, you can't live within this distance of a school, assuming they were some kind of pedophile or predator.
And that was Jessica's Law.
That was Jessica's Law. So they scaled that back. I think the legislators who supported that were pretty gutsy. And I think we need to make smart distinctions. We don't need a one-size-fits-all solution. At the same time, I don't think we're wrong or have been wrong to try to protect kids.
Well, no one can disagree with that, Jim. How do we fix it? Our show is produced by Davies Content. We make creative content for companies and nonprofits. Our producer, as always, Miranda Schaefer.
And our engineer, Denise Barbarita at Monolisa Studios.
And the wonderful music you're now listening to is by our composer, Lou Stravinsky.
Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.